The Varieties of Scientific Experience, A Personal View of the Search for God, by Carl Sagan, edited by Andrianne.
Editor's Introduction. Carl Sagan was a scientist, but he had some qualities that I associate with the Old Testament. When he came up against a wall, the wall of jargon that mystifies science and withholds its treasures from the rest of us, for example, or the wall around our souls that keeps us from taking the revelations of science to heart. When he came up against one of those topless old walls, he would, like some latter-day Joshua, use all of his many strengths to bring it down. As a child in Brooklyn, he had recited the Hebrew Vayahoptah prayer from Deuteronomy at temple services. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. He knew it by heart, and it may have been the inspiration for him to first ask, what is love without understanding? And what greater might do we possess as human beings than our capacity to question and to learn? The more Carl learned about nature, about the vastness of the universe, and the awesome timescales of cosmic evolution, the more he was uplifted. Another way in which he was Old Testament, he couldn't live a compartmentalized life, operating on one set of assumptions in the laboratory and keeping another, conflicting set for the Sabbath. He took the idea of God so seriously that it had to pass the most rigorous standards of scrutiny. How was it, he wondered, that the eternal and omniscient creator described in the Bible could confidently assert so many fundamental misconceptions about creation? Why would the God of the scriptures be far less knowledgeable about nature than are we, newcomers, who have only just begun to study the universe? He could not bring himself to overlook the Bible's formulation of a flat 6,000-year-old earth. And he found especially tragic the notion that we had been created separately from all other living things. The discovery of our relatedness to all life was borne out by countless distinct and compelling lines of evidence. For Carl, Darwin's insight that life evolved over the eons through natural selection was not just better science than Genesis. It also afforded a deeper, more satisfying spiritual experience. He believed that the little we do know about nature suggests that we know even less about God. We had only just managed to get an inkling of the grandeur of the cosmos and its exquisite laws that guide the evolution of trillions, if not infinite numbers of worlds. This newly acquired vision made the God who created the world seem hopelessly local and dated, bound to transparently human misperceptions and conceits of the past. This was no glib assertion on his part. He avidly studied the world's religions, both living and defunct, with the same hunger for learning that he brought to scientific subjects. He was enchanted by their poetry and history. When he debated religious leaders, he frequently surprised them with his ability to outquote the sacred texts. Some of these debates led to long-standing friendships and alliances for the protection of life. However, he never understood why anyone would want to separate science, which is just a way of searching for what's true, from what we hold sacred, which are those truths that inspire love and awe. argument was not with God, but with those who believed that our understanding of the sacred had been completed. Science's permanently revolutionary conviction that the search for truth never ends seemed to him the only approach with sufficient humility to be worthy of the universe that it revealed. The methodology of science, with its error-correcting mechanism for keeping us honest, in spite of our chronic tendencies to project, to misunderstand, to deceive ourselves and others, seemed to him the height of spiritual discipline. If you are searching for sacred knowledge, and not just a palliative for your fears, then you will train yourself to be a good skeptic. The idea that the scientific method should be applied to the deepest of questions is frequently decried as scientism. This charge is made by those who hold that religious beliefs should be off limits to scientific scrutiny, that beliefs, convictions without evidence that can be tested, are a sufficient way of knowing. Carl understood this feeling, but he insisted with Bertrand Russell that what is wanted is not the will to believe, but the desire to find out, which is the exact opposite. And in all things, even when it came to facing his own cruel fate, he succumbed to pneumonia on December 20th, 1996, after enduring 3 bone marrow transplants. Carl didn't want just to believe. He wanted to know. Until about 500 years ago, there had been no such wall separating science and religion. Back then, they were one and the same. It was only when a group of religious men who wished to read God's mind realized that science would be the most powerful means to do so that a wall was needed. These men, among them Galileo, Kepler, Newton, and much later Darwin, began to articulate and internalize the scientific method. Science took off for the stars, and institutional religion, choosing to deny the new revelations, could do little more than build a protective wall around itself. Science has carried us to the gateway to the universe, and yet our conception of our surroundings remains the disproportionate view of the still small child. We are spiritually and culturally paralyzed, unable to face the vastness, to embrace our lack of centrality, and find our actual place in the fabric of nature. We batter this planet as if we had someplace else to go. That we even do science is a hopeful glimmer of mental health. However, it's not enough merely to accept these insights intellectually, while we cling to a spiritual ideology that is not only rootless in nature, but also, in many ways, contemptuous of what is natural. Carl believed that our best hope of preserving the exquisite fabric of life on our world would be to take the revelations of science to heart. And that he did. Every one of us is, in the cosmic perspective, precious, he wrote in his book Cosmos. If a human disagrees with you, let him live. In 100 billion galaxies, you will not find another. He lobbied NASA for years to instruct Voyager 2 to look back to Earth and take a picture of it from out by Neptune. Then he asked us to meditate on that image and see our home for what it is. Just a tiny, pale blue dot afloat in the immensity of the universe. He dreamed that we might attain a spiritual understanding of our true circumstances. Like a prophet of old, he wanted to arouse us from our stupor, so that we would take action to protect our home. Carl wanted us to see ourselves not as the failed clay of a disappointed creator, but as star stuff made of atoms forged in the fiery hearts of distant stars. To him, we were star stuff pondering the stars, organized assemblages of 10 billion, billion, billion atoms, considering the evolution of atoms, tracing the long journey by which here, at least, consciousness arose. For him, science was in part a kind of informed worship. No single step in the pursuit of enlightenment should ever be considered sacred. Only the search was. This imperative was one of the reasons he was willing to get into so much trouble with his colleagues for tearing down the walls that have excluded most of us from the insights and values of science. Another was his fear that we would be unable to keep even the limited degree of democracy we have achieved. Our society is based on science and high technology, but only a small minority among us has even a superficial understanding of how they work. How can we hope to be responsible citizens of a democratic society, informed decision makers regarding the inevitable challenges posed by these newly acquired powers? This vision of a critically thoughtful public, awakened to science as a way of thinking, impelled him to speak at many places where scientists were not usually found. Kindergartens, naturalization ceremonies, an all-black college in the segregated South of 1962, at demonstrations of nonviolent civil disobedience, on The Tonight Show. And he did this while maintaining a pioneering, astonishingly productive, fearlessly interdisciplinary scientific career. He was especially thrilled to be invited to give the Gifford Lectures on Natural Theology of 1985 at the University of Glasgow. He would be following in the footsteps of some of the greatest scientists and philosophers of the last 100 years, including James Frazer, Arthur Eddington, Werner Heisenberg, Niels Bohr, Alfred North Whitehead, Albert Schweitzer, and Hannah Arendt. Carl saw these lectures as a chance to set down in detail his understanding of the relationship between religion and science, and something of his own search to understand the nature of the sacred. In the course of them, he touches on several themes that he had written about elsewhere. However, what follows is the definitive statement of what he took pains to stress were only his personal views on this endlessly fascinating subject. At the beginning of each Gifford lecture, a distinguished member of the university community would introduce Carl and marvel at the need for still more additional halls to accommodate the overflow audience. I have been careful not to change the meaning of anything Carl said, but I have taken the liberty of editing out those gracious introductory remarks, as well as the 100 or more notations on the audio transcripts that merely say, laughter. I ask the reader to keep in mind at all times that any deficiencies of this book are my responsibility and not Carl's. Despite the fact that the unedited transcripts reveal a man who spoke extemporaneously in nearly perfect paragraphs, a collection of lectures is not exactly the same thing as a book. This is especially true when the Pulitzer Prize-winning author in question never published anything without combing at least 20 or 25 iterations of every manuscript for error or stylistic infelicity. There was plenty of laughter during these lectures, but also the kind of pin-drop silence that comes when the audience and the speaker are united in the thrall of an idea. The extended dialogues and some of the question and answer periods capture a sense of what it was like to explore a question with Carl. I attended every lecture, and more than 20 years later, what remains with me was his extraordinary combination of principled, crystal-clear advocacy, coupled with respect and tenderness toward those who did not share his views. The American psychologist and philosopher William James gave the Gifford Lectures in the first years of the 20th century. He later turned them into an extraordinarily influential book entitled The Varieties of Religious Experience, which remains in print till this day. Carl admired James' definition of religion as a feeling of being at home in the universe, quoting it at the conclusion of Pale Blue Dot, his vision of the human future in space. The title of the book you hold in your hands is a tip of the hat to the illustrious tradition of the Gifford Lectures. My variation on James' title is intended to convey that science opens the way to levels of consciousness that are otherwise inaccessible to us. That contrary to our cultural bias, the only gratification that science denies to us is deception. I hope it also honors the breadth of searching and the richness of insight that distinguish Carl Sagan's indivisible life and work. The varieties of his scientific experience were exemplified by oneness, humility, community, wonder, love, courage, remembrance, openness, and compassion. In that same drawer where the transcript of these lectures was rediscovered, there was a sheaf of notes intended for a book we never had the chance to write. Its working title was Ethos, and it would have been our attempt to synthesize the spiritual perspectives we derived from the revelations of science. We collected filing cabinets worth of notes and references on the subject. Among them was a quotation Carl had excerpted from Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, the mathematical and philosophical genius who had invented differential and integral calculus independently of Isaac Newton. Leibniz argued that God should be the wall that stopped all further questioning, as he famously wrote in this passage from Principles of Nature and Grace. Why does something exist rather than nothing? For nothing is simpler than something. Now, this sufficient reason for the existence of the universe, which has no need of any other reason, must be a necessary being, else we should not have a sufficient reason with which we could stop. And just beneath the typed quote, three small handwritten words in red pen, a message from Carl to Leibniz and to us. So don't stop. Anne Trian, Ithaca, New York, March 21st, 2006.
Author's Introduction. In these lectures, I would like, following the wording of the Gifford Trust, to tell you something of my views on what at least used to be called natural theology, which, as I understand it, is everything about the world not supplied by revelation. This is a very large subject, and I will necessarily have to pick and choose topics. I want to stress that what I will be saying are my own personal views on this boundary area between science and religion. The amount that has been written on the subject is enormous, certainly more than 10 million pages, or roughly 10 to the 11th bits of information. That's a very low lower limit. And nevertheless, No one can claim to have read even a tiny fraction of that body of literature, or even a representative fraction. So, it is only in the hope that much that has been written is unnecessary to be read that one can approach the subject at all. I'm aware of many limitations in the depth and breadth of my own understanding of both subjects, and so ask your indulgence. Fortunately, there was a question period after each of the Gifford lectures in which the more egregious of my errors could be pointed out, and I was genuinely delighted by the vigorous give and take in those sessions. Even if definitive statements on these subjects were possible, what follows is not such. My objective is much more modest. I hope only to trace my own thinking and understanding of the subject in the hopes that it will stimulate others to go further, and perhaps through my errors, I hope not to have made many, but it was inevitable that I would. New insights will emerge. Carl Sagan, Glasgow, Scotland, October 14th, 1985. The Varieties of Scientific Experience. 1. Nature and Wonder, a Reconnaissance of Heaven. The truly pious must negotiate a difficult course between the precipice of godlessness and the marsh of superstition. Plutarch. Certainly both extremes are to be avoided, except what are they? What is godlessness? Does not the concern to avoid the precipice of godlessness presuppose the very issue that we are to discuss? And what exactly is superstition? Is it just, as some have said, other people's religion? Or is there some standard by which we can detect what constitutes superstition? For me, I would say that superstition is marked not by its pretension to a body of knowledge, but by its method of seeking truth. And I would like to suggest that superstition is very simple. It is merely belief without evidence. The question of what constitutes evidence in this interesting subject, I will try to address, and I will return to this question of the nature of evidence and the need for skeptical thinking in theological inquiry. The word religion comes from the Latin for binding together, to connect that which has been sundered apart. It's a very interesting concept, and in this sense of seeking the deepest interrelations among things, the superficially appear to be sundered, the objectives of religion and science, I believe, are identical or very nearly so. But the question has to do with the reliability of the truths claimed by the two fields and the methods of approach. By far, the best way I know to engage the religious sensibility, the sense of awe, is to look up on a clear night. I believe that it is very difficult to know who we are until we understand where and when we are. I think everyone in every culture has felt a sense of awe and wonder looking at the sky. This is reflected throughout the world in both science and religion. Thomas Carlyle said that wonder is the basis of worship. And Albert Einstein said, "I maintain that the cosmic religious feeling is the strongest and noblest motive for scientific research." So, if both Carlyle and Einstein could agree on something, it has a modest possibility of even being right. The universe is mainly made of nothing. Something is the exception. Nothing is the rule. That darkness is a commonplace. It is light that is the rarity. As between darkness and light, I am unhesitatingly on the side of light. But we must remember that the universe is an almost complete and impenetrable darkness, and the sparse sources of light, the stars, are far beyond our present ability to create or control. This prevalence of darkness, both factually and metaphorically, is worth contemplating before setting out on such an exploration. The PDF that accompanies this audiobook can and should be viewed. Begin with the two images that show several artists' representations of the solar system. The number of external galaxies beyond the Milky Way is at least in the thousands of millions, and perhaps in the hundreds of thousands of millions, each of which contains a number of stars more or less comparable to that in our galaxy. So, if you multiply out how many stars that means, it is some number, let's see, 10 to the... It's something like 1 followed by 23 zeros, of which our sun is but one. It is a useful calibration of our place in the universe. And this vast number of worlds, the enormous scale of the universe, in my view, has been taken into account, even superficially, in virtually no religion, and especially no Western religions. Thomas Wright wrote, "To what you have said about my having left out my own habitation in my scheme of the universe, having traveled so far into infinity as but to lose sight of the earth, I think I may justly answer, as Aristotle did when Alexander, looking over a map of the world, inquired of him for the city of Macedon. 'Tis said the philosopher told the prince that the place he sought was much too small to be there taken notice of, and was not without sufficient reason omitted. The system of the sun," Wright goes on, "compared but with a very minute part of the visible creation, takes up so small a portion of the known universe that in a very finite view of the immensity of space, I judged the seat of the earth to be of very little consequence." This perspective provides a kind of calibration of where we are. I don't think it should be too discouraging. It is the reality of the universe we live in. Many religions have attempted to make statues of their gods very large, and the idea, I suppose, is to make us feel small. But if that's their purpose, they can keep their paltry icons. We need only look up if we wish to feel small. It's after an exercise such as this that many people conclude that the religious sensibility is inevitable. Edward Young in the 18th century said, "An undevout astronomer is mad," from which I suppose it is essential that we all declare our devotion at risk of being adjudged mad. But devotion to what? All that we have seen is something of a vast and intricate and lovely universe. There is no particular theological conclusion that comes out of an exercise such as the one we have just gone through. What is more, when we understand something of the astronomical dynamics, the evolution of the worlds, we recognize that worlds are born and worlds die, that they have lifetimes just as humans do, and therefore that there is a great deal of suffering and death in the cosmos if there is a great deal of life. For example, we've talked about stars in the late stages of their evolution. We've talked about supernova explosions. There are much vaster explosions. There are explosions at the centers of the galaxies from what are called quasars. There are other explosions, maybe small quasars. In fact, the Milky Way galaxy itself has had a set of explosions from its center some 30,000 light years away. And if, as I will speculate later, life and perhaps even intelligence is a cosmic commonplace, then it must follow that there is a massive destruction, obliteration of whole planets that routinely occurs frequently throughout the universe. Well, that is a different view than the traditional Western sense of a deity carefully taking pains to promote the well-being of intelligent creatures. It's a very different sort of conclusion that modern astronomy suggests. There is a passage from Tennyson that comes to mind. "I found him in the shining of the stars. I marked him in the flowering of his fields." So far, pretty ordinary. But, Tennyson goes on, "in his ways with men, I find him not." Why is all around us here, as if some lesser god had made the world, but had not forced to shape it as he would? To me personally, the first line, "I found him in the shining of the stars," is not entirely apparent. It depends on who the him is. But surely there is a message in the heavens that the finiteness, not just of life, but of whole worlds, in fact, of whole galaxies, is a bit antithetical to the conventional theological views in the West, although not in the East. And this then suggests a broader conclusion. And that is the idea of an immortal creator. By definition, as Andruian has pointed out, an immortal creator is a cruel god because he, never having to face the fear of death, creates innumerable creatures who do. Why should he do that? If he's omniscient, he could be kinder and create immortals secure from the danger of death. He sets about creating a universe in which at least many parts of it, and perhaps the universe as a whole, dies. And in many myths, the one possibility the gods are most anxious about is that humans will discover some secret of immortality, or even, as in the myth of the Tower of Babel, for example, attempt to stride the high heavens. There is a clear imperative in Western religion that humans must remain small and mortal creatures. Why? It's a little bit like the rich imposing poverty on the poor and then asking to be loved because of it. And there are other challenges to the conventional religions from even the most casual look at the sort of cosmos I presented to you. Let me read a passage from Thomas Paine from The Age of Reason. Paine was an Englishman who played a major role in both the American and French revolutions. From whence, Paine asks, from whence then could arise the solitary and strange conceit that the Almighty, who had millions of worlds equally dependent on his protection, should quit the care of all the rest and come to die in our world because, they say, one man and one woman ate an apple? And, on the other hand, are we to suppose that every world in the boundless creation had an Eve and apple, a serpent, and a redeemer? Paine is saying that we have a theology that is earth-centered and involves a tiny piece of space, and when we step back, when we attain a broader cosmic perspective, some of it seems very small in scale. And in fact, a general problem with much of Western theology, in my view, is that the God portrayed is too small. It is a God of a tiny world and not a God of a galaxy, much less of a universe. Now, we can say, well, that's just because the right words weren't available back when the first Jewish or Christian or Islamic holy books were written. But clearly, that's not the problem. It is certainly possible in the beautiful metaphors in these books to describe something like the galaxy and the universe, and it isn't there. It is a God of one small world, a problem, I believe, that theologians have not adequately addressed. I don't propose that it is a virtue to revel in our limitations, but it's important to understand how much we do not know. There is an enormous amount we do not know. There is a tiny amount that we do. But what we do understand brings us face to face with an awesome cosmos that is simply different from the cosmos of our pious ancestors. Does trying to understand the universe at all betray a lack of humility? I believe it is true that humility is the only just response in a confrontation with the universe, but not a humility that prevents us from seeking the nature of the universe we are admiring. If we seek that nature, then love can be informed by truth instead of being based on ignorance or self-deception. If a creator God exists, would he or she or it or whatever the appropriate pronoun is prefer a kind of sodden blockhead who worships while understanding nothing? Or would he prefer his votaries to admire the real universe in all its intricacy? I would suggest that science is, at least in part, informed worship. My deeply held belief is that if a God of anything like the traditional sort exists, then our curiosity and intelligence are provided by such a God. We would be unappreciative of those gifts if we suppressed our passion to explore the universe and ourselves. On the other hand, if such a traditional God does not exist, then our curiosity and our intelligence are the essential tools for managing our survival in an extremely dangerous time. In either case, the enterprise of knowledge is consistent, surely, with science. It should be with religion, and it is essential for the welfare of the human species. 2. The retreat from Copernicus, a modern loss of nerve. All of us grow up with the sense that there is some personal relationship between us, ourselves, and the universe. And there is a natural tendency to project our own knowledge, especially self-knowledge, our own feelings, on others. This is a commonplace in psychology and psychiatry, and so it is with our view of the natural world. Anthropologists and historians of religion sometimes call this animism and attribute it to so-called primitive tribes, that is, ones who have not constructed instruments of mass destruction. This is the idea that every tree and brook has a kind of actuating spirit that, as Thales, the first scientist, said in one of the few surviving fragments of his work, there are gods in everything. It's a natural idea, but it's not restricted to animists, of whom there are many millions on the planet today. Physicists, for example, do it all the time, except where nature does not oblige. It is the commonest thing in the world in, say, the kinetic theory of gases, to imagine each of these little molecules of air that are busily colliding in front of us as maybe billiard balls. Well, that's not exactly projection, since physicists are not strictly speaking of billiard balls, but it is taking something from everyday experience and projecting it into a different realm. It's very common for physicists to refer to molecules or asteroids as guys. You can more easily imagine what a molecule or an asteroid is like if you imagine them as being something like us. And this, I believe, reveals the prevalence in this day of these ancient modes of thinking. Yet, you cannot carry this projection too far because sooner or later, you bump your nose. For example, when we get to relativity or quantum mechanics, we discover realms that are alien to our everyday experience. And suddenly, the laws of nature turn out to be astonishingly different. The idea that as I walk in this direction, my watch goes slightly slower and I am contracted in the direction of motion and my mass has increased slightly does not correspond to everyday experience. Nevertheless, that is an absolutely certain consequence of special relativity, and the reason it does not conform to common sense is that we are not in the habit of traveling close to the speed of light. We may one day be in that habit, and then the Lorentz transformations will be natural, intuitive. But they aren't yet. The idea that there is a cosmic speed limit, the speed of light beyond which no material object can travel, again seems counterintuitive, even though it can be demonstrated, as Einstein did, from an astonishingly simple and basic analysis of what we mean by space, time, simultaneity, and so on. Or, if I were to propose to you that my arm could be in this position, or in that position, but it would be forbidden by the laws of nature to be in some intermediate position, that would likely strike you as absurd, as contrary to experience. And yet, on the subatomic level, there is quantization of energy and position and momentum. The reason it seems counterintuitive is that we are not ordinarily down at the level of this very small where quantum effects dominate. So the history of science, especially physics, has in part between the tension between the natural tendency to project our everyday experience on the universe and the universe's noncompliance with this human tendency. Now there is another tendency from the psychological or social sphere projected upon the natural world. And that is the idea of privilege. Ever since the invention of civilization, there have been privileged classes in societies. There have been some groups that oppress others and that work to maintain these hierarchies of power. The children of the privileged grow up expecting that, through no particular effort of their own, they will retain a privileged position. At birth, all of us imagine that we are the universe, and we don't distinguish the boundaries between ourselves and those around us. This is well established in infants. As we grow up, we discover that there are others who are apparently autonomous and that we're only one among many other people. And then, at least in some social situations, there's a sense that we are central, important. Other social groups, of course, don't have that view. But it is generally those with privilege and status, especially in ancient times, who became the scientists, and there was a natural projection of those attitudes upon the universe. So, for example, Aristotle provided powerful arguments, none of them instantly dismissible, that the heavens moved and not the earth, that the earth is stationary, and that the sun, the moon, the planets, the stars rise and set by physically moving once around the earth every day. With the exception of this kind of motion, the heavens were thought to be changeless. The earth, while stationary, had all the corruption of the universe localized here. Up there was matter, which was perfect, unchanging, a special kind of celestial matter, that is, by the way, the origin of the word, quintessential. There were four essences down here, the imagined four elements of earth, water, fire, and air. And then there was that fifth element, that fifth essence out of which the heaven stuff was made. And that's why the word quintessential, fifth essence, comes about. It's interesting to see a kind of linguistic artifact of the previous worldview still present in the Oxford Unabridged, but it's amazing what's in the Oxford Unabridged. Now, in the 15th century, Nicholas Copernicus suggested a different view. He proposed that it was the earth that rotated and that the stars were in effect motionless. He proposed, moreover, that in order to explain these apparent movements of the planets against the background of more distant stars, the planets and the earth, in addition to rotating, revolved around the sun. That is, the earth was demoted. You know the phrase, another linguistic artifact, the world or the earth? What is the definite article saying? It's saying there's only one. And that also goes straight back to pre-Copernican times, as does the phrase, natural as it is, of the sun rising and the sun setting. Copernicus, by the way, felt his idea to be so dangerous that it was not published until he was on his deathbed, and even then, it had an outrageous introduction by a man named Osiander, who was worried that it was too incendiary, too radical. Osiander wrote, in effect, "Copernicus doesn't really believe this. This is just a means of calculating. And don't anybody think he's saying anything contrary to doctrine." This was an important issue. Aristotle's views had been accepted fully by the medieval church. Thomas Aquinas played a major role in that. And therefore, by the time of Copernicus, a serious objection to a geocentric universe was a theological offense. And you can see why. Because if Copernicus were right, then the earth would be demoted. No longer the earth, the world, but just a world, an earth, one of many. And then came the still more unsettling possibility, the idea that the stars were distant suns and that they also had planets going around them, and that, after all, you can see thousands of stars with the naked eye. Suddenly, the earth is not only not central to this solar system, but no longer central to any solar system. Well, there was a period in which we hoped that we were at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. If we weren't at the center of our solar system, at least our solar system was at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. And the definitive disproof of that occurred only in the 1920s to give you an idea of how long it took for Copernican ideas to reach galactic astronomy. And then there was the hope that, well, at least maybe our galaxy was at the center of all the other galaxies, all those many billions of other galaxies. But modern views have it that there is no such thing as the center of the universe, at least not in ordinary three-dimensional space, and we are certainly not at it. So those who wished for some central cosmic purpose for us, or at least our world, or at least our solar system, or at least our galaxy, have been disappointed, progressively disappointed. The universe is not responsive to our ambitious expectations. A grinding of heels can be heard screeching across the last 5 centuries as scientists have revealed the non-centrality of our position, and as many others have fought to resist that insight to the bitter end. The Catholic Church threatened Galileo with torture if he persisted in the heresy that it was the earth that moved and not the sun and the rest of the celestial bodies. It was serious business. Now, at the same time, another of the Aristotelian precepts was challenged. That was the idea that except for the moving of crystal spheres into which the planets were embedded, nothing changes up in the heavens. In 1572, there was a supernova explosion in the constellation Cassiopeia. A star that had previously been invisible suddenly became so bright that it could be seen by the naked eye. The Danish astronomer Tycho Brahe noticed it. Well, if nothing changes up there, how is it that suddenly a star appeared? I mean, suddenly, in a period of a week or less, from invisibility to something easily seen, and then stayed for some months before fading away. Something was wrong. Just a few years later, there was an impressive comet, the Comet of 1577, and Tycho Brahe, decades after Copernicus, had the presence of mind to organize an international set of observations of that comet. The idea was to see if it was down here in the Earth's atmosphere, as Aristotle had insisted it must be, or up there among the planets. Part of the reason that Aristotle had insisted that the comets were meteorological phenomena was his belief in an unchanging heaven. So, Brahe thought, if the comet is close to the Earth, then two observers far from each other will see it against different background stars. This is called parallax, which you easily can demonstrate by simply winking your eye, first the left and then the right, with a finger propped up about a foot in front of your nose. The finger seems to move as you blink. Brahe reasoned that if the comet was very far away, then the two observers who were far apart would see it in almost exactly the same part of the sky. You could determine how far away it was by how much it moved between the two different vantage points, how much the parallax was. And Brahe determined it was surely farther away than the moon, and therefore, up there, in the planetary realm, not down here where the weather is. That was another upsetting discovery for the institutionalized Aristotelian wisdom. Now, as science has progressed, there have been, one after another, a series of assaults on human vainglory. One of them, for example, is the discovery that the Earth is much older than anyone had expected. Human history goes back only a few thousand years. Many people believed that the world was not much older than human history, and there was no sense of evolution, no sense of vast vistas of time. And then, the geological and paleontological evidence began to accumulate, making it very difficult to see how the geological forms and the fossils of now extinct plants and animals could have come into being unless the Earth were enormously older than the few thousand years that had been projected. That is a battle still being fought. In the United States, for example, there are people who are called creationists, the more radical of whom insist that the Earth is less than 10,000 years old. The shorter the age of the Earth, the greater the relative role of humans in the history of the Earth is. If the Earth is, as we certainly know it to be, 4,500 million years old, and the human species at most a few million years old, probably less than that, then we have been here for only an instant of geological time, for less than 1/1,000th of the history of the Earth. And therefore in time, as in space, we have been demoted from the central to an incidental aspect. And then, Evolution itself was still a further disquieting discovery, because at least it had been hoped that humans were separate from the rest of the natural world, that we had been specifically put here in a way different from petunias, let's say. And yet, Darwin's historic work showed that we were very likely related in an evolutionary sense with all the other beasts and vegetables on the planet. And there remain many people who are enormously offended by this idea. This sense of offense has, I'm only speculating, deep psychological roots. Part of it is, I believe, an unwillingness to come to grips with the more instinctive aspects of human nature. But I believe it is essential to understand this if we wish to survive. I think ignoring that, imagining all humans are rational actors in the present phase, is enormously dangerous in an age of nuclear weapons. I think the discomfort that some people feel in going to the monkey cages at the zoo is a warning sign. Then, in the early part of this century, there was still another such assault, which came with special relativity. Because one of the central points of special relativity is that there are no privileged frames of reference, that we are not in an important position or state of motion. There is nothing privileged about the velocity that we have or the acceleration that we have. The universe can be understood precisely if it is true that we do not have a special frame of reference. Now, it's certainly true that there is something special about our position in time. The universe has changed. A microsecond after the Big Bang, it was quite different from how it is right now. So no one maintains these days that there is not something special about our epoch in the sense that the universe itself evolves. But in terms of position, velocity, and acceleration, there is nothing privileged about where we are. This insight was obtained by a young man who was opposed to privilege in the social sphere. If you look at Einstein's autobiographical writings, I think it is quite clear that this opposition to privilege in the social world was connected with his opposition to privilege in fundamental physics. Well, if we don't have a distinctive position or velocity or acceleration, or a separate origin from the other plants and animals, then at least maybe we are the smartest beings in the entire universe. And that is our uniqueness. So today the battle, the Copernican battle, is in somewhat covert form being waged on the issue of extraterrestrial intelligence. Now, this doesn't guarantee that there is extraterrestrial intelligence. It may be that Copernican insights, the principle of mediocrity, if you wish to call it that, worked for all these other things, but on extraterrestrial life, it doesn't. And we are unique. I will come back to that later, but I believe that the ongoing Copernican revolution is relevant to this debate as well. There is today another battlefield on which the Copernican insights are being attacked. It is connected with one of the classic arguments for the existence of God, that is, the Western kind of God, namely, the argument from design. The idea of the argument from design goes like this. Suppose you know nothing about watches, and you come upon an elegantly tooled pocket watch, and you open it, and everything is going tick, 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 tick. And there are all those gears and levers and burnished brass, and such things are not made in nature. Therefore, the existence of such a complex mechanism, the existence of the watch, implies a watchmaker. Now we go and look at an organism. Let's take a very modest organism, a bacterium. Well, you look in there, and you find a much more complex mechanism than a pocket watch. A bacterium has many more moving parts, much more information than what you would have to write down in order to describe how to make a pocket watch. And yet, the world is full of bacteria. They're everywhere, enormous quantities of them. And is it possible that this being, far more complex than a watch, arose spontaneously out of who knows what sort of collisions of atoms? Isn't it more likely that this watch also implies a watchmaker? That is one example of the argument from design, and you can imagine that every part of nature might be vulnerable to such an interpretation. Everything, that is, except utter chaos. Well, Darwin showed, through natural selection, that there was a way other than the existence of a watchmaker, a way in which it was possible for enormous order to emerge from a more disordered natural world without the interposition of any capital W watchmaker. That was natural selection. The ideas behind natural selection were that there was such a thing as a hereditary material, that there were spontaneous changes in the hereditary material, that those changes were expressed in the external form and function of the organism, that organisms made many more copies of themselves than the environment could support, and therefore that some selection among various natural experiments was made by the environment for reproductive success, that some organisms, by pure accident, were better suited to leaving offspring than others. Now, an essential aspect of this idea is that you need to have enough time. If the universe is only a few thousand years old, then Darwinian evolution is nonsense. There isn't time. On the other hand, if the Earth is a few thousand million years old, then there is enormous time, and we can at least contemplate that